You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Kava is it's a plant that you drink the roots, and it's found in the tropic regions across Oceania,
right, or
the Moana. You know, it's found in Papua, it's found in Pompeii, it's found in Hawaii, it's found in, you know, Samoa, Fiji, Tonga, and elsewhere. So it's kind of all over the place, and it's very similar to kawakawa, if you want to think about it like that. They're cousins,
right?
They're not the same species, but they're related species. And with kawakawa, I mean, if you look at the leaves of kawakawa, that essentially looks very similar to a kava leaf. It's just a lot smaller, so a kava leaf's like four times larger than that.
Yeah.
And you don't drink the leaves, you drink the root. It's been drunk for, you know, several thousand years now,
right,
across the Pacific. It's believed to have originated in Vanuatu,
okay,
where there's over 100 different types of kava. And so that's something to keep in mind as well, is there's all these different varieties, and
right,
they have varying levels of strength or effect that they can have. But generally, when you drink it, it's like a mild sedative, or has kind of like a very mild anesthetic feel,
right,
to it. It relaxes your muscles, it has anti-anxiety properties. You might feel a little bit of numbing in your tongue or your throat initially, but then that goes away. But it's very mild in comparison to a lot of other things. And so usually when people have never tried kava before and they come, they're like, oh, I don't feel anything, right? Because it's not alcohol, it's not marijuana, it's not coffee, it's not any of these other substances. It's very mild in comparison.
Right.
Now, if you drink more, and if you drink a strong variety for several hours, then you're going to have more of effects. But it's not a mind-altering substance either.
Sort of more like physiologically medicinal in a way.
Yeah, yeah. And so I do a little bit of research around music, and there's a Utah reggae group called Natural Roots, and they have a song about kava. And one of their lines is, you know, when they're drinking kava, they say, I feel irie from my head to my toes, but my mind is so clear.
Wow. Right?
So I think those lyrics kind of reflect the experience, yeah, of kava in that sense.
Kava clarity.
Yeah, yeah. And it's because it removes that stress, right? It has anti-anxiety, right, properties. It relaxes your muscles. But the biggest part of the medicine, I would say, is the mana, right? So from an indigenous perspective, kava is mana. It has a potency. It has a sense of authority. It can be the embodiment of ancestors. It represents, it's what's called, Dr. Kaili refers to it as a metonymical heliaki, which is heliaki is like a poetic metaphor in Tongan. And so kava represents the land. It's a metonym of land, right? So it's like a consumption of the land. And so there is, you know, all these other elements to it as well.
Yeah, it's sort of like a connecting force in that way. You ingest it, you're connected to your land.
Absolutely. And in the case of, again, there's all these different traditions. Kava is very diverse. I work primarily with Tongans.
Okay.
And so I'm kind of speaking more from that sense.
Mm.
But, you know, because everybody has different protocols and traditions around their consumption with kava.
Sure.
And in the context that I'm coming from, having been introduced through Tongan communities in Utah where I grew up, that's kind of how I got into kava when I was, you know, in high school, kind of heard about it, tasted it, and whatnot. But then I had a relative who became really involved in the kava community and brought me in. And so I've been doing it since I was 18. But it's a very social drink in that sense. And it's a connector. It brings people together. And that, I would say, is the biggest potency that's often overlooked, is the social medicine, right? Kava is a very important tradition in regards to mental health, because it's about maintaining community ties. And most of the time when I'm talking about community, I'm talking about kinship, right? So a lot of Tongan communities that drink kava together are related in the indigenous concepts of these large kind of, you know, clan groups and village-based groups. And so it is a way to maintain those kind of familial ties.
Totally.
And community. And so there's a social medicine that is part of the kava that increases the potency, I would say, of the effects, right? Is the community that's part of the,
totally,
I guess, the ritual or the practice.
Yeah. And you were speaking about how you work with Tongan specifically. And your research is centered around kava. So I guess I'm asking what the traditional uses are for kava in Tonga specifically.
Yeah. So I got introduced to it with the diaspora in Utah and the Tongan communities there. And with what is called Fai Kava, which is the, the way I like to define it is the more common or regular gatherings.
Okay.
And it can have, again, a variety of purposes for that.
Mm.
But as I've delved deeper into the research and over the years have learned that there's various layers and levels of kapa practices in sure. Tonga, right? So you have the regal or royal kava ceremony that's done whenever a new king or queen is crowned, and that's part of the bestowal of the paramount chiefly title.
Sure.
Then there's also chiefly kava rituals, and then there's the fai kava, which are regular ones, which it could be anything from somebody's home, you know, a small group of somebody's home with friends or family, to what's called a kalapu, which is an adaptation that's, you know, really probably emerged around the 50s and really kind of took off in the 60s and 70s in Tonga, which is the Tonganized version of saying club. And it was a way to kind of adapt kava practices in a shifting kind of a globalizing world and the introduction of, you know, modernity and all these other different ideas. And so it was a way to keep the tradition going. So a lot of old traditions have, I would argue, didn't disappear. They just kind of consolidated, right? So for example, kava was used for courtship. So if you wanted to date somebody or, you know, or court somebody, you'd take kava to that person's home and say, hey, we want permission. You ask the parents for permission for the daughter to serve and mix the kava, and while she's doing that, you're there with your mates and you're singing and, you know, and flirting and throwing out your poetry and all these things. And that still happens, but it's very rare now.
Okay.
But that still may happen in adapted settings.
Right.
You know, another traditional use for the regular gatherings was, you know, after the day's work of fishing or farming, you'd come back and, you know, with a couple of people and you'd, you know, talk about the day and prepare for the next day and kind of use it as a way to kind of unwind. And so there's all these different practices.
Yeah.
Traditionally that are still around, they're just kind of adapting,
transpired in new ways.
Yeah, especially with the change in labor, you know, once you go overseas, maybe you're not a farmer or fisherman anymore, maybe you're not living off of subsistence, maybe you work in a factory, maybe you work in a hospital, maybe you work, you know, wherever. And so you might still use kava to kind of unwind or reconnect with family that you don't regularly see.
Perhaps it's not so explicitly positive or negative, but do you think that the movement of it into the modern world has been positive, or has it sort of ruined the mana that we were talking about before?
That's a good question. I mean, it's one that's debated, right? So with the short amount of time, I won't answer it, but I'll just complicate it.
Yeah.
It can be a variety of things, right? So for people in diaspora, let's say, you know, the commodification of kava, you know, by, you know, traditionally it was you drink the roots fresh, right? It's a plant, it's kind of more, yeah, and but that doesn't preserve overseas. And so nowadays, you know, it's dried and pounded, and that makes it easy to export, and so communities overseas can access it. So on one hand, that could be seen as a positive to maintain connections. But on the other hand, this growing interest with kava, in what I guess what I'd call the hipster consumer market.
Totally.
can be negative in the competition for something that is, you know, for the most part stayed within the communities and is shared through community relations, like in my case and in others. You know, Pacific Islanders expand, they have, you know, all these relationships globally, and they bring people into their practices. But once we put it into, let's say, the machine, if you will, of the global economy, then that power or autonomy is being removed or challenged out of the communities deciding who and how they share it and how they do that, and then kind of disconnecting it from that and saying, okay, now we're going to put a standardized price and value that isn't yours. It's not a value of mana, it's a value of dollars. And so that can be challenging. I mean, since I've been doing this research for 3.5 years now, and since I began, the prices in kava have tripled.
Wow.
And the quality is now another thing, right? So with the global commodification, you have the creation of so-called high-quality kava, which really is what people were drinking always.
Right.
But with the creation of high quality is the creation of low quality. And people, you know, putting stuff that wasn't traditionally there, or drinking stuff that wasn't usually drunk in higher quantities, or even cases of people putting in sawdust or different things to pad it out, right? So that's the thing that's always overlooked, is when you create high quality product, you're also creating low quality product. And before that, it was
not supposed to happen.
It was all mana, right? Yeah. It was all kava. And so, and if it's going up in price, and if you're in the working class in diaspora, then that makes it difficult to access not only a cultural tradition, but for many people, what can be, you know, a deeply spiritual practice, or, you know, part of the indigenous metaphysics. Because again, you're bringing the land with you, you're transporting it, you're consuming your land, you're in a sense embodying your ancestors in that process.
So I guess it can be a positive thing, but if you want to partake, you need to listen and share.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
Yeah.
The machine doesn't always do that. And I guess that's what I would say is, if we were to compare it to, let's say, other foods, sacred foods, you know, my ancestry is Mayan. And, you know, we invented chocolate. You're welcome to the world. For those who weren't aware, right, who thought the Swiss did. You know, that was something that happened through colonization, right? As we had this sacred drink that we would actually drink very similarly to the way kava is used. We used it in religious ceremony, we used it in marriage ceremonies, we used it in a variety of different settings, and it was considered an elixir of the gods, a spiritual drink, and has in a sense been removed. And so we're fighting now to revitalize our traditions of chocolate and the continuation of what we've been able to hold on to as Mayan people, but you know, it's now been removed in a sense, and now has a different value to it. And there's so many substances we could look at. You know, there's Coca-Cola, you know, people that drink cola drinks, right? This originally was and still is flavored by coca leaves, right? In the U.S., though, you know, only the Coca-Cola company can import coca leaves. But if you're Quechua or an Andean indigenous person and living in the U.S., you can't bring in coca leaves legally, even though it's a spiritual part of your spiritual traditions and even cultural practices.
It was theirs first.
Yeah. I mean, coffee is the other one, right? Yeah. We don't think about it. Yeah. Coffee, you know, how many people have been introduced to coffee through an Ethiopian kava ceremony, through relationships with people from Ethiopia? Most haven't. And we drink, you know, like when people consume coffee, what's the function of it, right? It's, you know, most of the time it's very individualistic. I mean, some people do drink it socially, but for the most part, you go have your coffee to get you through the day. Yeah. Or people will drink it. I mean, since I've been in academia, it's been really interesting to see how much coffee is consumed by people around me.
Totally.
And it's, you know, the relationship to that is completely changed. Yeah. And that's kind of the direction I fear kava is going, because although it's a really powerful, you know, practice to escape or to slow time down from especially fast-paced modern life, if it's only used as a remedy to the anxieties of modern life, then it's going to become just like coffee. It's not actually, you know, so the mana, I would argue,
all this other mana that you've been talking about,
exactly. And I think that's what happens, is, you know, it becomes the opposite of coffee, right? Coffee is used to get through the day and get through the labor that, you know, we're subject to in modern life in the current political economy, and kava is going to be used as is that's what I think is the appeal for the, especially the hipster market, is all they're like, oh, we need something to de-stress or to move out of it. And it's like, you know, this has been a practice for thousands of years, an uninterrupted practice among specific communities, and now they're going to, you know, the prices have gone up, and they're going to have to compete with this, you know, large market that wants to access it, and they don't have to access it through community. They can access it through, you know, middlemen and, you know, the commodification process and global economy. You know, don't mean to nerd out too much on it. That's just a, you know, so yeah, I mean, there's, it's a variety, it's a complicated mix where, and there's, and there's, then there's farmers, and there's even a few Pacific Islanders who are jumping into this. And personally, I think it'd be great to see even more, because it's happening, right? It's happening whether we like it or not.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I think the majority of it is not Pacific Islander owned.
Yeah.
There is the Royal Kava Bar in Utah that's Pacific Islander owned, and it's positive to see them, you know, at least having people from the community able to benefit, if any, from the monetary potential. Kava Fight is another one that's has a Pacific Islander who's behind it. And so I think that's another thing to be aware of. Like with any product, is where is it coming from?
Yeah.
How's it being produced? And where is that going to? Are we going through middlemen? Are we directly, you know, impacting the community, and how so? And so
totally.
That's why it's complicated, right? Yeah. Like, you know, I have my fears, but at the same time, people are trying to survive in the current realities of our world. Yeah. And if farmers want to sell it, and if people want to create a kava bar and they're in the community, then, you know,
it's up to them.
It's up to them, and I'd rather see more of that personally than it be dominated by outsiders, because that's when
totally.
Then it becomes coffee, becomes all these other things where we miss out on the potential I would say the mana, the potential power that comes from the social and cultural knowledge that is directly linked to food, right? Food isn't isolated from people.
Yeah. I guess that's a component of conscious consumerism as well. That's kind of a hipster
movement as well,
but it could be a positive one if we made it a positive one.
Yeah. And maybe that's what we should do, is challenge that and say, what does that mean, right?
Yeah.
And how do we move? I mean, if we have to consume, then how do we do that more mindfully?
Yeah.
And at the same time, let's not let that be the end all. How do we shift out of that, where trade isn't new, right? Trade is old.
Age old.
That's age old. But the way we do trade in the last 500 years or so with our current political economic system has changed and dramatically transformed in the way things are produced, the scale of things. I mean, the byproduct of our current economic system is waste.
Yeah.
You know, like, we produce waste. I mean, over the last few hundred years, that's the majority of what we've produced.
It's masses and masses
of it. And so that's, so, you know, part of mindful consumption, I think, is how do we move out of consumption and different modes of trade and exchange. That indigenous knowledge, I think, is crucial in learning, right? We're not going back to the past. We can't. The point is, how do we learn from the past? How do we learn from indigenous knowledge that remains in the present and how that adapts?
Just reignite the humanity of it.
Yeah. I think that's the optimist side of me. You
know? Yeah.
The pessimist side of me is like, oh, it's happening already in front of me. And so we'll see, right? Time will tell. And I'm hopeful, but I'm also cautious.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess to finish, I guess one of the key messages that we can take away from your research and research of this kind, which, like, thank God, is starting to come through universities a lot more now, in terms of celebrating resources that we have, especially as members of the Pacific, that we have from living in the Pacific, while ensuring we uphold, as we were saying, the mana. What kind of, like, what can we take away from the kind of work that is being done?
Yeah, I think my hope is to to listen, to learn. To one of the power of GAVA is that it, you know, one of the things I'm arguing in my thesis is that it collapses time, right? It slows things down, and that's why it's so powerful. And it's been used for many years in that way, where it can slow things down. And regardless of what time period we lived on the earth, that's always been an important part of not just knowledge production and reflection, but positive mental health as well. And I think that's something that's really important. Another thing about GAVA is one of the things I'm arguing as well is that it reveals truth, right? It's somewhat like hip-hop culture in that sense. But like hip-hop culture, it can also be controversial in communities, right?
Yeah.
Because the revealing of truth can be good, it can be bad, and it could be the ugly, right? And so sometimes it's about, like, again, I'm not saying it's good or bad. It's mana. It's potent. It has a power around it. And if we recognize that, we'll see that there's tapu, there's a setting apart or a protection around it that is knowledge that helps us to know how to appropriately engage or use, and how do we adapt it and continue to understand it. Being led by those who have maintained this uninterrupted practice, you know, from age old. And that's for me. I'm grateful I've been able to be a part of it, and for the communities who have brought me in and I've been, you know, engaging with since I was introduced to it. So that's always my source of, you know, direction for that.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.